Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
All right, well, Michael, the thing that I've been wanting to talk to you about for about a year now, I guess, is from Louisiana, where, you know, last year they expanded their school voucher program and everybody got worked up about the voucher part of it. But meanwhile, the same legislation created what to me was this very fascinating thing called a course choice program. And coincidentally or not, in Florida a few weeks ago, one of our very futuristic thinking state senators filed legislation that would create something similar. And so I know you're totally on top of these things and very excited about these things. So the first thing I wanted to ask you was, why is course choice such a big deal? Why should we be excited about that too?
Yeah, so it's a great point because we're seeing it in states right now across the country, starting to take it up. Florida was arguably the first to dive in, except it was just for Florida virtual school courses. Mm. And then Utah and Louisiana, right, have come in with their own flavors of it. I think what's exciting about it is a couple things. One, it obviously extends access to education for all students, regardless of their geography, to high-quality learning opportunities. So it opens up a world of educational choices that goes beyond just schooling options, but says regardless of the school you're in, you can now have access to any class. That's exciting. The second thing I think that it does that's even bigger than that is that we see this world of online learning getting increasing adoption in schools, and through blended learning, through the massively open online courses in higher ed, right, more and more of our learning is going online. And what I think this does is actually sort of jumpstart that and put it into overdrive. And what's exciting about online learning is that it actually moves us beyond a seat time system and hopefully into a mastery-based learning system that's far more student-centric, so that children can get what they need when they need it, and they only move on once they've mastered something. But if they already understand something, they can accelerate, right, and actually get higher and higher in their learning. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's going to start to usher in the future of learning in some exciting ways. Now, the last thing that I think these course choice bills are interesting about is that they start to move the barometer of what they're paying from just funding seat time, the number of minutes a student sits in a seat, to actually worrying about, did the student pass the course itself? And so there's a part of it that's completion-based funding. I think we'd love to get to a point where there was performance-based funding, where there was part of it based on actually a student passing an objective set of assessments. But at least we're moving the ball forward where that some funding in the Louisiana bill, 50%, only is given to the provider once the student has successfully passed the course. And that's a big sea change to start funding, in this case, outputs, not quite student outcomes, but closer rather than the inputs, which the system today is based on.
So you see big implications for this in terms of funding, too. It could shake up how we fund things now.
That's exactly right. I think it opens the door. And my own bias has always been that I think it's going to be incredibly hard for the existing system to move to a performance-based funding schematic just because it's not built around those assumptions. And it's a little bit like saying to a hospital, now you're only paid for the procedure if the person was cured, when in fact, you know, the sorts of things that hospitals treat are so complicated that it just doesn't make sense. That performance-based funding just clashes with their business model. Mm-hmm. But in different types of enterprises where you've made the time variable in the case of learning, you really can pay for this performance-based. And I think you'll start to see the system come more and more out to that world, and that really will be the future of funding.
Michael, you mentioned MOOCs, and that's obviously getting a lot of attention at the higher ed level. But are there implications for that at the K-12 level, or at least at the high school level?
I think so. And I'll say it actually, I'll into the course choice thing as well, because what I think you're going to start seeing is course choice in many ways will make districts compete and offer their own online learning options so that students continue to work through the district. And so many of the enrollments may not actually be through the course choice mechanism, but may stay within the district, which is great if that gives students better quality options, right? Mm-hmm. And I think MOOCs will be a part of that because particularly for advanced courses, the opportunity to disrupt, really, the AP system and say, hey, I just passed MIT Physics. right, that's going to be far more meaningful to a lot of students than getting a 5 on an AP exam.
Right.
And so I think we may start to see, you know, I don't know how it'll play out, but I think we're going to see some different arrangements there that either extend advanced courses through the MOOCs or even more exciting, start to disrupt that system completely to be focused on far more expert sorts of experiences for lots of students. I think that could get pretty interesting.
Well, it's funny you mentioned a physics course from MIT, because that's the exact same example that the state senator I mentioned before, Jeff Brandis, mentioned when I talked to him about his course choice legislation down here. He said, you know, if MIT developed a physics course that anybody could take online, why wouldn't we want to have that as an option for our high school kids to take in lieu of whatever other, you know, physics course they wanted to take? And I guess, you know, that would be true for any number of courses. I mean, if somebody out there has something that's stellar and they put it online and it's available to everybody, it seems like the cream would rise to the top and, you know, students would be able to take the best anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think you're going to start to see platforms emerge in the future that also help visualize even within the course for students. Hmm. And so, you know, in many ways, what all that does is it just blows up the geographic categorization scheme we've had for where someone goes to school. And so it's actually, wherever you are, you can get the best experience for you, right? And then it'll always be that for you, because you may love the MIT course, I may love the one that has a couple Sal Khan videos and has a simulation, right? And different ones will work for us in different places of our background knowledge, whatever, you know, maybe the mathematics we understand or don't, and so forth. But why we have that best experience for us? We can clearly get it, and it's basically free. How can we not make that a part of the system and be giving actual credit for it, I think is right.
Okay. How do things like course choice intersect with the traditional school choice options that, you know, we talk about a lot now, like charter schools and vouchers? I mean, those things are still relatively in their early stages. You know, people are still in a lather about them. And yet they sound almost old school now next to course choice and MOOC. So how do those things fit together, or do they?
Yeah, you know, I think it's still an open question. My sense of it is that the great thing about the course choice is it really allows us to start unveiling what we think of as a school. And so it sort of takes school choice to a whole new level, puts it on steroids in some ways. I sometimes look at the people who want to start magnet schools, and I think, yeah, you know, why do you need to do that? Because you can deliver any science, engineering, math experience to, you know, anyone anywhere, and you can keep them, with, you know, close to home and with their friends. Mm-hmm. So math almost feel outdated. So in one sense, it goes beyond them. In the other sense, I think it's actually likely to be far less threatening to the traditional system in this, which is that districts can actually utilize online courses to enhance their offerings, in essence, right? To disrupt the way that they currently do the classroom experience, to offer their students in them any access to the best no matter where they go, which should actually make them far more competitive, I would think, with the private school options or charter school options that are coming on the scene. And so if they're smart about it and think about the budgeting in creative ways, I think it could be a pretty big boon to make them far more competitive.
Unless there's something about private schools and charter schools that make them more nimble and maybe more adaptable to incorporating these things into their system.
I think that's right. Okay. I think that's the question, and I think that's part of the policy conversation too, right? As long as school districts, and particularly the schools in them, really are constrained by the funding formula and, you know, so many input-based requirements and you can only use this bucket of money for this sort of thing, you're actually inhibiting their ability to innovate and adapt. Whereas charters, at least the notion behind them, is that we give the school principal significant leeway to use the resources in the way it makes sense for their population, which should give them a lot more opportunity to adjust. I'll say, though, there's a couple questions on that. One is, at least the charter operators that I know, they're not so interested in the course choice because they think very seriously that integrated learning experience that they create for students, and being able to modularize that into different courses doesn't seem to be too interesting to them. That may be okay, though, right? Because they're using the online courses themselves and just integrating it in really thoughtful ways. So I'm not sure that's a bad thing. I'm just not sure students will avail themselves directly of it.
Okay.
If they've made the choice to go to a charter school. The second question is on independent schools, which is, at least my experience, is that the private schools, actually in many, it's dangerous to generalize, but many of them are actually far more conservative and risk-averse than public school districts. And so, while in theory they may be more nimble and less constrained, it doesn't seem to be playing out that way in actuality, in many ways right now, anyway.
Okay. Well, I guess all these are open questions and the race is on, so we'll see what happens.
And the more racing that there is around student outcomes and the more competition between them around the right things, I think is great, right? So I think in some ways that's part of, and this is how they all work together, I think, as an ecosystem that's really, really important and healthy, quite frankly, to get people innovating on behalf of students in ways that they might not have otherwise.
Okay. Hey, about 6 months ago, there was a piece in EdWeek about the course choice program in Louisiana, and the story had a number of people quoted, including Checker Finn and Kevin Wellner, who are guys you normally don't think of as being on the same page, but in this case, they both said they were concerned about quality control with course choice. And so I wondered, you know, is that something you're worried about too? And if not, what is your biggest worry about what's happening with that?
Yeah, so it's definitely a concern. I think it's also, there's a huge opportunity there and to make us significantly less concerned. The concern is that while they've moved to completion-based funding formula, most of the states, at least at this point that I'm aware, haven't tied a portion of that to actually passing an objective assessment. And so I often tell people, honestly, I could solve the dropout crisis tomorrow in America just by giving everyone a diploma. But it wouldn't solve the underlying thing we actually care about, right, which is did they learn something and are they ready for their life and career and so forth. And so I think having objective assessments that we tie, you know, 5-10% to when a student passes it of the funding or something like that is going to be really important. And that shouldn't be so hard in itself, but the really important part is that the assessments then have to be on demand so that they can't just be taken at one fixed point during the year,
right,
say in May, because online courses, right, I could complete in September. Why shouldn't I be able to take the that exam or that assessment right then and there? And so that's, I think, going to be the really challenging thing on the quality spectrum, is being able to create a robust system of assessments that allow us to deliver them on demand for students as they complete courses and so forth. If we do that, then actually, I think you can almost open it up to the Wild West in some sense, because providers that don't provide experiences that allow students to actually pass those will go out of business pretty quickly.
Okay. Here's a question for you from Doug Tuthill, who's the president of Step Up for Students down here, and he thinks about the future of education constantly. I think he probably thinks about these things when he's mowing the grass. So he wanted to know how much thought you've given to how all this increasing customization is going to be managed and who's going to manage it. I'll try my best to channel Doug here. So let's say, you know, a few short years from now, you have a kid in Georgia who's in a private school on a voucher, but he takes a couple classes from Florida Virtual School, and then he takes another course choice online from a teacher in Seattle and another from a teacher in Buffalo. So, who tracks his overall progress, and how do you divvy up the accountability between all the different providers? And, you know, you mentioned the funding earlier. I mean, it just seems like all this gets real head spinning real quick.
This is where I think it gets super interesting and super unknown at the same time. And I think these are the really, to me anyway, I think these are the really interesting questions. My sense of it is that we will need a school of record still for students who are who are there to ensure that students not only have mastered their courses or their subjects, but also that they're sort of taking ownership of the whole child, if you will. You know, making sure that they've had a whole high school experience where they've, you know, participated in sports and learned to play with teams and all those sorts of things.
You're still going to need a home base.
And I don't know exactly. Yeah, I think that's right. You'll still need a home base. And those experiences then that you farm out should be on performance contracting, I think, so that, you know, there's that portion of funding only comes when you've actually, the student's actually successfully mastered the learning itself. And then I think once you start with that principle, some of these things become a little bit easier to figure out. But quite frankly, I think there's going to be a lot of support needed to help schools move to some of this performance-based contracting and to figure out different ways of doing this. And my sense of it, anyway, is that Common Core could form a great sort of underlying basic, if you will, underneath it, and then very quickly students start branching out from that into, you know, whatever interests them, guided by the school itself and their parents. And that, you know, I don't think we know exactly how that'll play out yet, but it becomes pretty interesting to think through the implications.
Okay, well, I had a spin-off from that, which is the parent part of it, and this will be the last thing I ask you. And thanks again for taking all this time to talk to me. So, you know, as this customization really ramps up, and we got even more choices among schools, and then we got choices among even courses, it sounds like, you know, real quickly there'll be a pretty intimidating catalog of choices for any parent to face. So how do we help parents manage all these choices? And is that something we should all also be giving more thought to?
Yes, I think it is the short answer. Two different thoughts on it. One, I think what you'll actually see happen, Heather Staker has written about this quite a bit, that in disruption, what we tend to say is that the disruptive innovation tackles the simplest problems first, if you will. We call it with the least need of performance requirements. And her theory has been that actually, intuitively, students that come from the, you know, really solid nuclear families with lots of wealth constitute that low-end performance in the schooling debate because their parents don't need as much performance from the public school system. They can find different options for their kids. They're very aggressive in researching through the different options and figuring out, you know, we can unbundle this in this way and find this sport team for you here and this course there and so forth.
Sure.
And so a lot of the disruption may start there before it goes up market, if you will, and handles the really difficult problems around students who don't come from those sorts of experiences, which is an interesting thought. The second part of it is, and this is now quoting Clay Christensen, who talks a lot about when you saw sort of the evolution of shopping, if you will, in this country, that back in the 1800s, the first mega department stores, in essence, basically served as a portal for people so that they could find any product, you know, for any need. And whenever they had the job of, gee, I need to find something, they would just go to this big, massive department store that would help deliver, you know, that they knew would carry reliable brands that could help deliver this thing to them. And then over time, as people became articulate about their needs, malls started popping up with very purpose-driven stores where you'd say, okay, when I want this type of thing, I go for this. When I go for this, I go here, and so forth, right? And in much the same way it happened with Sears, you used to go through the catalog, which would have everything, and then at some point you could start to say, no, I'm going to go to Best Buy for this, Best Buy for this, Home Depot for that, on and on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his theory sort of was that in the beginning of most markets, you need these sorts of portals that help guide people to quality choices and make some of these decisions. And then over time, those give way as people become much more articulate about what they need and understand the marketplace far better. And so I wonder if that analogy is true for education as well, where we'll see these portals and rating systems and so forth, rotten tomatoes of education that start to pop up and give you expert advice on navigating this landscape And then over time, people will become more articulate and say, you know, no, when I need the math experience, I go to Khan because he just has the best stuff. And when I need this experience, I go here because they, you know, they can provide that menu of options. So just a bit of a theory without without a great idea of how it evolves, but hopefully it helps give some sense of how we might think about it.
Well, let me make sure I understand that right. So perhaps there will be choices among managers and navigators. There'll be different entities cropping up who can say, look, I can help you navigate this stuff and help you figure out the right fit for your kid. Come to me and we'll help you out.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. Or you'll see some sort of portal websites. You know, I can imagine EdSurge, for example, intends to create a robust map, if you will, of all the products that are out there, with from reviews and from educators and things like that to help people navigate this world. So it could be a digital sort of thing, or it could be, you know, something much more hands-on. I'm not quite sure at this point, but I think you will have that goal or advisor-type mechanism that helps people navigate this early on.
Okay. Well, Michael, this was great. Thank you so much. What a lesson I just got from you about all these things coming down the pipe. Thanks for all your time.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure always.